Hey everybody and welcome. This is Donovan Bankhead with Springfield Music, and I appreciate you dropping in and listening to the podcast. With the Bow Better Bands podcast, my intention is to talk with our fellow educators across the state and share some of their best tips, tricks, and best practices. Also, maybe even share some of the things that they're struggling with so that we can help each other out, because we're all dealing with so many of the same issues in your programs. And us, as your school music dealer, want to try to be a resource to help you solve some of these challenges and issues. So anyway, we always appreciate you listening. And if you have ideas or tips or would like to be featured on the podcast, reach out to me and let me know. Donovan@springfield-music.com. All right, let's jump in. Hey everybody, so my guest today is Chris Sprague, and Chris has been teaching for 30 years. The last 27 have been at Bradleyville, which is a small rural school in southwest Missouri, serving 220 students in grades K through 12. Her teaching assignments include band 6th through 12th grade, K through 8 general music, and vocal music from 9th through 12th grade. During her tenure at Bradleyville, her bands have received numerous accolades, including being selected to perform at the MMEA conference in 2014. She's had multiple years of straight one performances at the Misha All-State Large Ensemble Festival. She's currently serving as president of MMEA and previously served as an MMEA band vice president. She's also been heavily involved in the MMEA mentoring program for new teachers since its inception. And in 2019, she was honored to receive the MSU Outstanding Alumni Award. And in 2014, she was humbled to receive the John East Spirit of Orpheus Mentor Award, an award voted on and presented by the directors of the South Central MMEA District. She's an active clinician, adjudicator, and mentor. Her hobbies include fishing with her husband Matt and gardening, and she's a 40-plus year fan of the Kansas City Chiefs. I also want to mention that this conversation, we talk a lot about teacher retention, teacher dropout, teacher burnout, and it gets dark before there's light at the end. So I want you to, I'm just going to implore you, listen to the whole thing. Don't listen to the first half and then decide you've had enough of this and start Googling for how to resign. So hang in there, because Chris does give you hope and inspiration and some specific things you can do to turn around some of the challenging situations that you may be experiencing. That, as a matter of fact, I'll go on a limb and say you are experiencing in your program. So it's worth listening to the whole thing. The other thing I want to ask for is maybe a little bit of grace on my end, because some of these topics I got very fired up over and got very engaged in and very motivated and sometimes outraged. And so I got up on a bit of a soapbox, and so, and even talking with some of our current political struggles. If you are someone who feels opposite of me, I hope you'll just take this as my opinion. And if you feel differently than I feel or found that something I said is wrong, I welcome you to reach out to me, and I would welcome a conversation with you about it, because I'd like to be right on it. But, and I hope that you take that my some of the soapboxing and grandstanding I'm doing is just because I'm passionate about it and I want to see our teachers succeed. I would not be in the position I'm in today as the owner of Springfield Music had it not been for music educators and for music. And so it's something I feel very, very deeply about. So if I step in any nerves or hurt any feelings, please know that's not my intent, and forgive me. But that being said, and one other thing that we should mention too. One of the complaints that we're dealing with in the teacher dropout is the pay. And certainly that's something that needs to be better. But one thing that we would be remiss to not acknowledge is that the retirement system in Missouri for teachers is actually quite good and quite generous. And it's something that, as one considers the merits of teaching, they should factor in our retirement system here. Okay, no further ado, let's get to Chris Sprague. So we were just sort of having our chit chat before, we were just, Chris, you were mentioned you were feeling a little blue because we had intended to talk about mentorship. We think we're going to take a quick detour and talk more about teacher burnout, teacher dropout, and kind of what's going on with that. And we're certainly seeing that not only in music education, but we're just seeing it in education across the board. And not only in Missouri, we're seeing it across the country. And certainly, I think this was something we were seeing even pre-pandemic, but boy, the pandemic has just thrown gasoline on the fire to make it difficult. So with that set up,
Why don't you tell me kind of what you're seeing from your end on teacher burnout and teacher dropout?
We're exactly right, Donovan. This was a problem before the pandemic, and this is just truly just exacerbated all the problems that we've been seeing. We've had less and less people enrolling in teacher education. And I really feel like in my mind, what a lot of that stems from the fact that when, and I'm not going to try to make us seem old or anything, but when you were and I were younger, teaching was this very well-respected profession. I mean, we weren't paid a lot still, but people went into it because they wanted to help kids. And that was the centermost idea of teaching. And we were willing to accept the lower pay and some of the longer hours and things because it was a well-respected profession by our peers, by our colleagues, by our communities, by just the general public. And I think through the years, as we've become more and more vilified in the education field, people are like, why bother? Why would I want to choose a career where I'm going to have to put up with all these things, going to have to put up with low pay, and yet I'm still not going to be respected. In fact, I'm going to be attacked by the general public. So I think we're seeing less and less people enroll in education because of that. And I can't blame them. And then, of course, with the advent of the passage of the minimum wage law, which is great, don't get me wrong. I think that's fantastic. But when a person can go to work right out of high school, go to work at Walmart and make $600 less a year than a beginning teacher, there's a problem with that. I mean, Missouri is 49th in teacher pay, 49th out of 50 states. And to me, that's just absolutely ridiculous. And then we wonder why we're having a teacher shortage. So just things are so compounded right now, I think, is part of the issue. And then, of course, the pandemic makes everything 10 times worse. Music educators had to change and completely how they taught last year. And we were dealing with things, obviously, none of us knew. And so the stress of that compounded with these other issues, it's just made it this firestorm. And I believe, too, that this year has been disheartening for people because we thought it would be better. And it's not because it's still so frustrating, the things that we're still dealing with and the behaviors that we're seeing out of kids, because we forget, I think, that kids have been under the stress too, and they don't know how to handle it. So they bring that into the classroom and they don't know what the parents have been so stressed out. The younger ones don't, but yet they act out in behaviors that we're not used to seeing. So I really think that, again, it's such a firestorm of so many different factors that we're dealing with right now. And I think that it's disheartening right now. And I hear from teachers, obviously being in the position I am, I hear how the frustration and how it's just so hard, and I get it. And I want to understand that. And I do understand that. Don't get me wrong, because it's been hard for me too. I think everyone looks to me and thinks, oh, you know, she's an old educator and this is easy for her. And it's not. It's just as hard for me as it is for everyone else. But I also look at it looking backwards, because I look at our young teachers and I think they must think, I mean, because every young teacher feels that way anyway, I can't do this for the next 30 years because we, no matter how good their college preparation is, nothing prepares you to go into the classroom. It just doesn't. There's no possible way. Even student teaching, we want to talk about student teaching prepares them. Unless they're student teaching in the exact same school district that they're going to be in, it doesn't really prepare you. I see this all the time. And of course, my passion is for small schools. Not that I'm not passionate for large schools, but there's a lot more help because you're not the only person on staff that's teaching music there. So you have at least one other person that you can kind of bounce ideas off of, and you're not the only one. And typically in our rural programs, that's where we get our first year teachers. And I get so frustrated with this because I'm always saying, no one would expect a math teacher to teach K through 12 math. They would think that's ridiculous, but that's what we expect out of our teachers in K-12 schools. We expect them to know the entire discipline, and it's just not possible. I mean, I've been doing this now. This is my 30th year teaching. This is 27 at Bradleyville, where I've taught K-12 those 27 years. And I can tell you that had it not been for those first 3 years in a different program, I probably would have quit too after those first two or three years at Bradleyville, because it's so hard. Yeah. And I finally have realized when I tell young teachers, it's like, you just got to hang in there. I mean, really, truly, if they will just hang in for those first 3 or 4 years, they start to see things get easier and easier. You're not spending as much time planning. You're not spending as much time worrying about your classroom management, because it's a skill. We forget, we think it's something we automatically have, and we don't. It is a skill that is learned, just like you can learn how to conduct and you can learn how to play your instrument. But for some reason, when we're teachers, we think and expect a first-year teacher to be just as good as a 30th year. At the 30th year, it just doesn't happen that way. So I'm sorry, I get really passionate about that.
No, I love that. I just want to add real quick and then let you carry on. But the last two podcasts that I've done that you haven't been able to hear yet because they're not out, but both of them, we spent quite a bit of time talking about building culture. And when you want, it takes time and energy and effort to build a culture. But once you have a positive culture going, that also makes things easier because there now becomes a cycle, a progression, an expectation that things start to handle themselves without you having to do everything. But those first few years, you're in a program, you're trying to build a culture, trying to change things. Like, it just takes an enormous amount of effort and can feel overwhelming, but it won't be 30 years of those first 3 years is the point you're making. It gets better and it gets easier.
Exactly. And that is so true. It's always interesting to me that when young teachers ask me, well, how do you discipline? I was like, well, I don't. Because when they're 5 years old, they learn how to act when they walk in my room. So that when they're 15, they still know how to act in my room. So that's one of the advantages of teaching in the K-12 program, because you're building that culture when they're five. And so when they are in the band program or the choir program, the expectation is already there. So I don't have the discipline issues that a lot of other teachers have, but you're exactly right. It's building that culture, and it is exhausting at the beginning. But once you start it, and you then you don't have to do it anymore because the older kids are doing it for you. I can't tell how many times some young kid will say something dumb, and one of the older kids will, I shouldn't say something dumb, something not, if they know that they're poking the bear, and the older one will look at him and say, we don't do it that way. This is how you're going to handle it. And I don't even have to say a word. Right. So it's building that culture. And they're like, yeah, don't poke the bear. This is how we're going to take care of this.
Right. Right. I love that.
You know, it is. It's so much fun because you get to see the older ones teaching the young ones how to behave. It's awesome.
I want to go back to something you said early on and have a conversation about this. You mentioned about how teaching used to be a more respected profession, which I agree with. I've heard that before, but I had a thought that hit my head as you were talking about that. Is anything respected anymore? Because I don't know that I can find anything that I think is really culturally respected. We don't respect our politicians, sometimes deservedly so. I'll not get into that deeply, but so we don't really treat that institution with respect. We often don't respect our frontline workers and essential workers. We see the kind of treatment that those people put up with. We see what we expect and demand and the turmoil we put like our healthcare workers through. So we don't really respect them. We often seems like we don't respect people that are working blue collar jobs that are necessary. We often don't seem to respect people who've been very successful and innovative. Like, I'm not sure if we respect anybody. It seems like there's a general lack of respect. And it seems like that also carries through to what we even see in student behavior, because they feel this semester in particular, I see that they're more emboldened to be disrespectful to authority figures. And on the one hand, I believe that people should, you know, they have their rights and should be treated a certain way. But man, like the blatant disrespect that I see happening and that I hear from my wife that is happening regularly with her, you know, just the foul language that's directed towards her. And you know, for her, it's a good week of someone doesn't tell her to F off or call her a bitch or something like that. And I'm half tempted to not even, you know, blank out those words and use them directly because the students are bold enough to use them to her. Why should I be civil enough to, you know, use a replacement? But I'll be civil. But I think, you know, it wouldn't have been that long ago that if a student would have spoken that way to a teacher or any authority figure, you know, there would have been severe discipline that would have corrected them to get them to know that you can't talk to people like that because there will be really bad repercussions. And I fear that not only is this creating an environment that makes it unhealthy for teachers to be in, I feel like it also makes an unsafe environment for teachers to be in, feel like it makes an unsafe environment for students to be in, because in my wife's school, they've already had a suicide this year, and I would not be surprised if there's more. So the discipline they have is completely ineffective. And then you're setting, if a student at this young formative age is learning the lesson that you can tell an adult in authority to go F off, and there's virtually no repercussion. Well, if you try that out in the real world as an adult, that's how you usually end up dead or in prison. So I'm very concerned, like, what is our discipline and our procedures doing to actually help these students? And I don't know, I'm ranting because I don't have a solution, but I see it as a huge problem, and it's exacerbating this teacher dropout problem we're having, because it, you know, as you mentioned, they don't feel respected. It's hard to feel respect when some dumbass, you know, seventh grader tells you to go F off, you know. So fix that for me, Chris. How do we fix that?
If I knew Donovan would write a book and retire.
Let's do that.
You know, I think you're right, though. I think as a society, we have gotten away from this basic respect for others. And you're right. We're seeing it more and more in the classroom. And I'm not sure how to fix that. I really am not, except that we have to be the lights. What happens if all of our good teachers give up and say, hey, we're not putting up with this anymore? You know, and at the same time, we do need to take care of our mental health. We do need to take care of ourselves. But we also have to go out and realize that if we are going to change the world, it has to start with us. It has to start with the students that are sitting in front of us. And yes, you're going to have that stupid seventh grader that's going to say that, but you're the only one that may be able to reach him or her, for that matter. And I really think, and I know we've kind of painted kind of a dark cloud here, and I do think it's going to be bad for a little bit. I really do. But I think that it's going to get exponentially better, because I think that people are finally going to wake up and realize that we have to pay teachers as the professionals they are. We have to have basic respect for adults back into our classrooms and into our homes, for that matter. Because I would just bet money that kid that's saying that is saying the same thing to his parents.
Well, I think now, parents are saying that, because Belinda also had a call earlier this year where she had a discipline problem with a child, called home to talk to mom, and she was telling mom about the behavior, and Belinda kind of wraps it up, and the mom says, I'm sorry, when did this happen? She's like, it was today. And she's, well, what time today? She was, is it 10 o'clock this morning? She was like, right, so during school? And Belinda's like, yeah. She's like, well, that sounds like that's your problem then, not mine. Like, that was the mom's response. So yeah, if the parents have that lack of respect for teachers, professionals, people in authority, then it's certainly going to translate down to the student. And like I said, I feel bad for these students, because it's monkey see, monkey do. They're going to end up falling in that right. same path. That's not a path that's going to lead to happiness and success. It's going to lead to failure, frustration, and misery, which is not a great thing for them, but it's also not a great thing for not only just for teachers and other professionals, but just my wife in general, which then therefore affects my life, which is the problem, you know? So that's why I'm on this soapbox. I want to get this solved, because this is affecting me daily. Oh my gosh. Well, I hope, you know, maybe we're getting close to rock bottom as a society, and that will turn around. I appreciate, I mean, I know you're my guest, so for me to push back, I feel like it's probably not right, but I'm going to do it anyways. But I appreciate what you're saying, and I know that you're right, that we need to just try to be the change we want to see. But I think we're not enough, and I do think we need to see our administration and stuff getting involved. And we need to see just a general societal and cultural shift of people being more respectful to one another, being more reasonable, and you know, using maybe better critical thinking skills. I don't want us to like necessarily respect everyone's cockamamie ideas, and we just have to accept like everything, even if it's totally insane. But I think, you know, maybe trying to get people to use logic in what we make decisions, and just look at things and do a little bit of analysis on what makes sense and what doesn't. And then trying to treat those things and people deciding as a society what our decisions are going to be and move forward on those things. I think if we can get back to that, which is what we've done mostly over the course of our history that I can think of off the top of my head, then I think we could see this turn around. But the way the path we're on right now feels concerning, and it doesn't seem like I see it turning around anytime soon, but I'm hoping maybe this is the bottom and then we we come around.
Donovan, it's hard because how do we as teachers, because you're so divided in the classroom too. It's like, and that's what the kids are hearing. How do you be that light of reason and teaching that we do accept, not accept, we do respect all views. You know, we need to respect that. We can respectfully disagree, but we don't know how to do that anymore. And how do we teach kids that when they see our public figures that can't respectfully disagree with one another and still work to get things done? It's terrifying.
It's hard to respectfully disagree with someone. It's easy to respectfully disagree when we just have a difference of opinion, right? I used to be conservative, but at one point I would have felt like, well, you know, we need less government assistance and people just need to, like, you know, pull themselves by their bootstraps and like dig in and work hard and do all that kind of stuff. And someone else could have an opinion like, well, actually, I don't know that that actually works. And there's cases of systemic poverty that, you know, they don't even have bootstraps to pull. And there's been layers of opposition put against them. And so there needs to be something that helps to remove some of those obstacles so those people have a chance. Okay, we can have a difference of opinion on how to fix that problem. But both of those are reasonable positions to hold and to discuss. But what we've been dealing with over the last 4 years is not reasonable. It's one view of reality, a normal position to take, and then another view that is not based on reality or anything. It's just craziness. And I think where it gets difficult to respect people is when they're coming from the crazy side. You know, this fear of getting vaccinated right now, it's not a normal position for a person to take. We've had vaccines for decades and decades and decades, and they've been successful. This thing has been administered millions, hundreds of millions of times. Like, and we know what the risks are, which are minimal for it. Whereas we see what happens with COVID, and those risks are monumental compared to the vaccine. And we can't even agree on that, which is simple science. It's just simple science. And I get that not all of us are scientists. I'm certainly not a scientist. My degree is in music education. So like I'm not a scientist, but I respect those people who have spent their entire lives studying science. And I respect, and then they've built their knowledge based off of other people who have spent their entire lives trying to learn how the world works. And when you get a consensus among those people saying this is safe, yes, they might be wrong, but they're more likely to be right. And they're way more likely to be right than I would be second guessing them. And the fact that we just have no respect, to go back to what we were talking before, and trust that, man, these people are spending their entire lives doing this and built off of other people's research. This is the most likely accurate and the right thing to do. Therefore, I'm going to do it. The fact that we can't trust that as a society and move forward is damning, I think, for where we're at today. And I hope, I don't know what's going to cause it to change. You'd think a global pandemic would do it, but it hasn't. But I hope something will. Okay. Well, we'll move on here. I didn't mean to get on a soapbox there. I just got frustrated. So yeah. So I think part of the problem is it's hard to respect people when it's more than differences of opinion. It's dealing with fact versus fiction. And I think that's where it gets difficult. But even in those situations, we really must be civil and definitely show respect, especially, gosh, we need to show respect to people that are serving. I'm all for challenging authority. I think authority should be challenged. But if someone is serving me, you know, like, and there is no greater servant, I think, really, than an educator. An educator is giving their life to impart knowledge and wisdom and hope for a better future to someone else. Like, man, if you can't show appreciation, respect, and kindness to those people, then there's really something wrong with you. So I really hope that as a community and as a society, we can get back to that. I think that would help quite a bit with the dropout. But the other thing you mentioned is the rising wages. that we're seeing rising wages in other areas of the economy. And of course, I think in general, businesses can react more swiftly and more quickly to these kinds of things than maybe what we can in government. But that certainly is a challenge. But sometimes also, even when districts try to address it, they stumble out of the gate and sort of fail. And a recent situation that occurred that if my understanding is correct and someone knows it better, please do correct me, because I want to be right on this. So if I'm wrong, someone tell me. But the Springfield District, which I believe is the largest district in the state, recently revised their stipend schedule and raised stipends significantly, which is great. So for all those teachers that are doing extra duty, like band directors, their stipends would be increased. But rather than what the district did is they increased them substantially, but rather than have teachers get substantial raises, they tried to basically take away any years of your ladder towards stipend ownership, and they tried to reset those and just put you within a couple of percent more of where they'd be on this new plan. So if you came into this with 15 years of service and the new stipend plan would mean you get an extra $4,000 in stipend, they tried to reset it and bumped you back down to like year one or two, so you'd only see like a 3% increase. And somehow, someone in this massive school district with this huge administration with all this money thought that was going to go over well. And it didn't take long for the teachers to think, wait a minute. So if someone new comes into the district next year and then does the same job I do, but they have 10 years of experience because they're new, they would get the 10-year stipend where I'm only getting the 1-year stipend. Hell no. Like, you know, to their credit, they did eventually end up reverting that and they're going to make it right. It's going to take them a couple of months to square it away, but they are going to do the right thing. But they didn't do the right thing right out of the gate. And to me, that would have been
right. Well, then why not?
Yes. I was telling Belinda about this last night. You know, Springfield Music is essentially run by three or four of us at the leadership. There's three or four of us that make those types of decisions. We would have known better than to do that. You know, and we're just a tiny company compared to the SPS school district. Like, how did they not know any better that that's going to go over like a turd in a punch bowl, like resetting everyone's years of experience for earning stipends? Like, man, you're messing with their money. You think they don't? Yeah, teachers are committed and they do this because they have a deeper love and stuff like that, but they're not doing it for free and they want to get paid. So
right. Well, and that's part of the issue, is that we have people making decisions for educators that either A, have not done the job, or have not done the job in 10 or 15 years. Yeah. And that, or we have people at the legislative level who think they know all about education because they were once a student, and they're making decisions for teachers without teacher input. And that's the biggest problem right there. If you want to get me on a soapbox, get me started talking about some of our legislative decisions that we've made about education at the state, federal level. I get really, really irate about what, again, we're making rules for educators who they have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, yeah. Absolutely none. And on the same idea, and while I please don't take this the wrong way, I love our higher education people, but so many of our young teachers are being taught by educators who maybe only spent 2 or 3 years in a public classroom and then went into higher ed. They really don't know what's going on. They really don't. And I get really frustrated by that, because we're trying to prepare these young people to go out. And I really think that's part of the problem with the disconnect that's happened over the past 10 years or more, is that we have students being in college, being trained by people who didn't do the job. We need people like me, and I'm not saying I'm the person to do it, but we need people to put 30 years in a classroom to be training educators, not people to put 3 years in a classroom training educators.
I think there's probably some kind of middle ground between there. I know a lot of educators that have taught 15, 20 successful years on up to 30 or 40s in some cases that would make excellent collegiate educators. But you're right. Not a whole lot that I've seen that have 3 to 5 years of experience. I think, boy, that person really has a gift to share everything they've learned. I mean, 3 to 5 years, you're
again, to figure learned.
Out what you need to know. Like, you know, you just hardly know what you're doing in that point.
It's a learned skill. And it's the same way even in administration. Is so many of our administrators, they didn't have any classroom experience, or they had maybe 2 or 3 years of high school experience, and now they're an elementary principal, and they really don't know. And it's just the whole problem is compounded, I really believe, by the lack of experience at all levels. And I think that is our biggest problem right now, is people they don't understand what we actually need as educators in that classroom, and what we actually need to be successful and do our job as well. It's just like, again, this year where you have all these administrators wanting to put on all these new programs and implement all this new stuff for our teachers when they're already stretched to the breaking point. That is an administrator that doesn't understand what's going on in the classroom, or a legislator that doesn't understand what's going on in the classroom.
If we're
going
to have a revolt, then we need a revolt by dragging our administrators and legislators into these classrooms, sitting up at the front of the class, not sitting in the back with a clipboard, and let them stand on that podium, or let them stand in front of that smart board and experience firsthand what this is like. And then not let them come up with the solutions, but then let them pull the people that are in the trenches to see, like, well, what should be done here? You're the one that's doing this every day. How do we fix this? Because now that I've experienced it, I too see that this is a problem. I don't understand how you do it every day. I think the minute you get someone who's in a position of power and authority subjected to the same kind of challenges and frustrations that our educators are, you'll start to see things change. I've always reminded of, when I think of stuff like this, of a story that happened years ago. One of the longest term employees we've had at Springfield Music was the second guy that I hired. His name is Mitch Brashears. And gosh, Mitch has been super influential in my life, and not only a great coworker, but a good friend. And years ago, we used to have a no return policy. So we would do exchanges, but we didn't really do returns. I mean, we would, but generally no returns. This was over a decade ago, because now we do. But anyway, so Mitch had worked with a customer, and the customer needed a return. And so Mitch came back to me and was like, hey, I got a customer up front. He bought a guitar, wants to return it. When did he buy the guitar? Well, it was about a month and a half ago. I was like, man, our exchange policy is only 30 days. Like, you know, that we're not doing that. Doesn't make any sense. He's like, well, in this case, it does. He's got this issue and that. Like, I feel like it's the right thing to do. And I was like, no, the policy's clear. Like, that's tough. This is me sitting in my office. Mitch says, cool, that's fine. Yeah. Why don't you come up and tell him? And I was like, it's not my job to tell him. It's your job to tell him. He's like, yeah, I got it. But why don't you come up and do it? I don't want to do it. Like, okay. So I strut on up there, like, yeah, I'm going to show you, like, this is how you do it. And within about 30 seconds of talking to this person, I realized right off the bat, Mitch was right, that the refund was in order and that I was being an asshole. And like, so we did exactly what the customer wanted. And after it was over, I pulled Mitch aside. I was like, next time that happens, do it this exact same way. If I'm ever like this obstinate, you know, where I'm just in my own bubble because I'm in my office and I'm like disconnected from reality. And getting exposed to that right off the bat made me realize his solution was the right solution. And I should have trusted and listened to him first and not second guessed it. So I think if we can do that with our administrators, and I think that goes everything from a building administrator, because I see, even in my experience, and I know this isn't across the board. I know that. I know there's good administrators out there. But I see from the assistant principal level all the way up to the superintendent level of a total disconnect from reality of what's actually going on in these classrooms every day. So we need to demand that those people get in front of these students and stand next to these teachers and see what's going on, and that they demand change together. And if anyone would like me to carry that pitchfork and torch, I will happily do that. You just tell me. So happy to do it. And then that's how Springfield Music lost all of its school accounts. Right? Gained a lot of friends and supporters, but all the administrators, like, you can't use this. So. Oh gosh. Okay. I feel like this has been a lot of fun. We're getting on all these soapboxes, but now let's talk. We've got some challenges. We've got this general lack of respect. We've got poor behaviors and ineffective discipline, which is causing our educators to lose hope. We've got legislators and decision makers that just don't have enough classroom experience and recent and relevant classroom experience making decisions. We do have an opportunity for some solutions and hope. But before we get to that, I want to throw one more like dark cloud into the mix. And you had mentioned something earlier. We talked a little bit about grit. And also I started talking a little bit about exposure. And from my perspective, and I'll tell mine first, because then I want you to talk about yours after, because I think they're sort of a nice one too. I see a lot of people that get out into the field. And from our position, we're very, very fortunate to get to see so many first-year teachers. And I have a heart and a passion for young teachers. And because I know what it felt like the first time I had to stand in front of my wife's beginning or her first band and realizing, how do we begin all this? So I just, that fear lives inside me still. And so I have all this sympathy and empathy for them. I feel like anyone that wants to become a music educator, we need to get them exposed more to what is actually involved in the job so that they can make a better decision if it's a suitable job for them. Because I think for so many of us, like for myself, like I was so fortunate that almost my entire music career through public school, I was in almost excellent programs the whole time. I had one year where I was in an average band program, and I moved around a bunch. But every other year, I was in an excellent program. I started it in Verdigris, which Yul Hanna just was a great music educator and had a great passion for jazz. And then at that high school, I went to Union and just had great instructors there and a tremendous experience. And so, of course, like leaving all that, I thought, well, this is what I want to do. Like, you know, probably not a good enough player to play trumpet for a living. Plus, I like to have a more consistent paycheck. So I'll be a music educator. And I think so many of us that get into that, we don't know what else to do in music. We want something with security. We came out of a great band program. And so we just get into this without actually recognizing what all the challenges are. And then I don't know if there's enough. And I want to stress, I don't know. So if someone does know and I'm wrong, then correct me. Or Chris, if you know if I'm wrong, correct me. But I don't know if there's enough challenge when someone's expressing interest in becoming an educator, if they're not suited for that, are they being, challenged enough by that? And then that's a double-edged sword too, because I've talked to people who were challenged and told they wouldn't be a good educator that ended up teaching for 30 years and becoming excellent educators. So I don't know what the answer is with it, but what are your thoughts before you discuss grit, which is the tenacity to stick with it? Part of that would help by making sure we at least get the right people in the right spot. How do we do that?
Well, part of the issue, I think, is exactly what you're talking about. There are very few educators that had my experience. I had an okay program, but I was in a really tiny school, and it was okay, maybe 20 or 30 every year. And so it's so unusual to have someone like me to go to our university, especially our larger universities, and have very high quality background before you go out into the field. So I don't think we're doing a good job. Well, and then you have these students who have typically been in these big suburban band, and also choir too, for that matter, because I teach both, but these big suburban music programs, and then they go to a well-known college with a big music program, and they have all these experiences, and then they go to work at Bradleyville, mm-hmm. where there's two kids in the program when you start. And they have no idea how to take it from that to make it successful, because it's totally out of their wheelhouse. One thing that I did a couple of years ago is I contacted a local university and said, look, you're not really giving these kids a true life experience of what it's like to teach in rural education. It's not your fault, but you're typically placing them in the Nixes and Ozarks and Willards, which is great. They're wonderful programs and they're getting great experience, but that doesn't prepare them to go teach at Bradleyville. And student teachers need that type of experience, because that's typically probably where their first job is going to be. Well, none of them want to go teach at Bradleyville because they don't have, A, they don't have that experience, B, they've never heard anything good about small programs, and C, it's out of their wheelhouse of experience. They have no idea. So I told them, I said, I know it's not practical for people to come with me and student teach with me. I do have a few, and I've had a few over the years, but not very many, because it's an hour drive from Springfield. Mm-hmm. I said, at least have them come down and spend the day with me. And so a few years ago, we did that. And I had about 30 college kids that came down and spent the day with me. And so many of them were just blown away by the whole atmosphere of small school. They couldn't even wrap their mind around the same building, 240 kids, and that's it, in the same building. They couldn't even fathom that. And so it was a really good experience for them. And a couple of them have gone on to teach in smaller programs. And I'd like to think that kind of opened their eyes a little bit about what can be in a small program, and also gave them a little bit of a background of how to handle some things and how just that's a whole different world, because it is very, very different. Kids are different. There are some people like to say kids are the same where they are, but they're not. They're very different in a rural setting as compared to a setting, an urban or suburban setting, where it's just different experiences. And you as a teacher have to know how to navigate that. You've got to know how to, and I've used this experience because it's so typical for a small school. A few years ago, I had a student teacher, and she was sitting in the back of the room when the counselor said, "Hey, I got a kid that got in trouble at art. He needs to finish his fine arts credit. Will you take him?" I'm like, the only hour I had it was during my high level instrumental class where the kids were preparing for contests. That was their hour to practice for contests. I'm thinking, what am I going to do? It was typically by ball players and people that had after school things were going on. I have like 7 or 8 kids in that class that I would just go and help on their solos and groups and things. I'm like, what am I going to do with this kid? So he came in and I just kind of visited with him. I said, and I don't remember what his name is. We'll call him Mason. That wasn't it, but we'll call him that. I was like, "Mason, what do you like to do on the weekends?" He's like, "Well," he said, "you know, I like to fish." So, "Oh, good. I love to fish." And we talked fishing for a little bit. I said, "What do you do as a hobby?" He said, "Well," he said, I make gun stocks." I was like, "Really?" I said, "You get any pictures?" And I could see over, you know, my student teacher behind her eyes got about this big around. And she's like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe we're talking about guns at school." So he brought his phone up and he showed me some pictures of his gun stocks. You know, we visited for a little bit about guns and just talked a little bit about that. And the bell rang and he left. And I looked at her and I said, "You watch, that kid will do anything I ask him to do because we made that connection." Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, I had this music theory program and anything else that he could do independently. He came in. I mean, this kid could care less about music theory. But because I made that connection with him, he came every day, did his business. We had a great relationship, finished the year. It was fine. So making those relationships, she was just floored that I was talking about guns in school. It's like, well, right. It's a different world.
Right.
We can do that. You know, but I had to find a way to make a connection with that kid. So making sure that we do that with kids, had I not had that background of experience of growing up on a farm and all that, I would not have had that opportunity to make that connection. And I think that's where we struggle a lot of times with young teachers that get out who've had those backgrounds, just like you did with great programs, larger schools. They don't have the background to go into a small school and be able to be successful because they don't know how to build relationships. It's not because they're not qualified. It's not because they don't know the material. It's building relationships. Right. That is the key to being a successful teacher. It's not about what you know. It's how do you get along with people? How can you get kids to do what you want them to do? Because you have to be invested in them. It's not about how they can make your ensemble better. You've got to be invested in the person they are. When you meet them at the door and say, "Hey, I was at a ball game last night," or you text them and say, "Hey, saw you guys won. Great job." I mean, you've got to be able to build those kinds of relationships. And in a small school where you have kids that are doing everything, they're not just in band, they're not just in choir, they're not just in orchestra. They're doing band, FBLA, FFA, FCLA, every single little group. I shouldn't say little, but all of the groups that they're in. And you've got to be invested in all of that to make them successful and to be a successful teacher. And I don't think we did a very good job of recruiting people like me who went to small programs. You know, our universities, especially the larger ones, have got the draw and they've got the name. So all of these kids that are maybe feeling not as successful, maybe, I never met All-State Band. I mean, I met All-District Band, but I never met All-State Band. And I would not have felt qualified. If we were in this day and age, I probably wouldn't feel like I was good enough to go to one of these larger universities with better programs. I wouldn't even attempt to do that, whether I was good enough or not, because I would be scared to try that. So I don't think we do a good job as universities of recruiting those types of kids into our programs, helping them be successful so they can go back into those kinds of rural situations or urban situations. That's another one. We don't do a good job of educating our urban kids to go back and make a difference in the setting that they're used to. I think that we need to do a better job of, and I hate to use that phrase because I don't like that program, but the Grow Your Own program, I hate that program. That's not what I shouldn't say I hate it, but it's not really the answer. Mm-hmm. But we do need to be very specific about making sure that the kid that's going through our program is qualified to go back to a situation and be successful. And so I think also too, through the years, and I'm going to get off my soapbox now a little bit, through the years we've been taught, maybe not now so much, but when I was going through, you were taught, hey, you get a job at Bradleyville for 3 or 4 years, get some experience, then you move on to your next job, and then you move on to the job you want to retire from.
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with making that first job the job you want to retire from? What's wrong with making a place like Bradleyville successful?
Yeah.
I mean, those kids need just as good an education as the kids in larger programs.
Yeah.
And they can be just as successful. Maybe not have as many, but they can have the kind of success that you're looking for. And I'm the perfect example of that. My students have not suffered because I was from a small school. And I feel like they've been very successful through the years because I stayed and helped them to be successful. And it's not because of me. This is a relationship we've built for 27 years. There are 9 teachers on staff, Donovan, that I've taught.
That's amazing.
It's such a unique relationship now. One of them, her kids now are starting to graduate out of my program. And one of them, for example, he just texted me the day of that he was going to ask his fiance to marry him. He told his family, and then he told me, I was just his teacher, not related. You know, it's those kind of relationships that you build with in a small school for so long. It's really phenomenal. I know the last time we took a big band trip, not one phone call, not one question, not one text. It's like, here's my kid, 4 days, bye. Because they knew me, they trusted me. I guess that's a good thing. We don't do a good job of telling the good things about teaching in small schools. We don't do that.
I did an interview with Ron Sykes. I think it's the first episode of his. And he did a great job of selling it. Because honestly, up until that point, I was still probably one of those people of like, I don't know if it was me, I don't know that I'd want to do it. But then after listening to that episode, I was like, oh, I had this wrong. Like, boy, now I don't think I'd want to go into one of those big schools. Like, there is a definitely an attraction at being at a small school. And it's not just like I think before when I first started really thinking about it, of course, like hearing you talk about it, because you've been such an ambassador for it. But I thought like, well, gosh, it's just like a calling, you know, or God bless those people who will do it. But then you listen to Ron talk about it, you're like, oh no, everyone else really has this wrong. Like, there is a real benefit and attraction to being in a small school. Like, the influence that you have, the fact that you get to build these relationships with these students from K through 12, even if you're not teaching K through 12, but you're seeing and interacting with those kids, like how you get to pick the things that you're doing in your program, like and what types of ensembles you're doing and what your focus is going to be, the kind of community support you get, like it's really, really attractive, especially for someone who just doesn't have like a ton of ego and like, well, I want to have this band program that my peers will see and like, you know, fawn over. Like, oh, I don't care about that. I want to teach music education and build relationships and change lives. Like, I don't need, you know, trophies necessarily. So I think, man, for those types of people, it's a very attractive position, and I think way more attractive than it gets credit for, and in many cases more attractive than those larger programs. Not to say that a larger program doesn't have something to offer. I mean, being part of a team and stuff like that's also pretty attractive too, but there's challenges in both districts or both size programs.
Right, and I think you're exactly right in the fact that building those relationships, if that's important to you. I mean, I have those kids for 13 years, and it's there's nothing more special than watching them come in my room as 5-year-olds and then watch them walk right to me across that graduation stage. Because where the band sits, they come right down and get their diploma and come right down the stairs to me. And I can't tell you how many hugs they've come to me before they've gone to their parents. And that's pretty humbling, humbling experience. But to get back to our original thought here, I think we need to do a better job of recruiting people to these smaller positions. And I will say that over the last few years, I've been seeing more and more people willing to stay in those smaller programs and see what they can build and see where it can take them. Because I think, again, we've just always had that fallacy that, you know, we want this, like you said, this big, huge job. That's what we want. And that's our goal. Why not make where you're at bloom where you're planted? I mean, I'm a firm believer in that. And then if the opportunity comes that you've done everything you can, it's time to move on. Then great. But maybe you're someone like me who just found huge success and huge personal satisfaction in being in a small program. It has been the greatest joy of my life to serve there. And it's not been easy, just like anywhere else with any other job. Mm-hmm. But the benefits have far outweighed anything negative by staying there all these years.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned something that I wanted to kind of
pick your brain on. And you may have an answer for this. You may not. So if you don't feel compelled, if you don't know how to, if you don't have a solution, but you mentioned just the importance of building connections with students, which I, you know, certainly agree. But there's two challenges to this. Okay. So the first challenge that I'll put before you is it's easy to build connection with people you can relate to, and by people in general, both coworkers and students and parents. So if people are similar to you or have similar thoughts, feelings, and beliefs to you, pretty easy to build that connection. Very difficult for most of us without training or experience to build connections with people that are very different than us. So that's a challenge one. Challenge two is that one of the things that's so beautiful about band is that we have a wide tent of students that get involved in band. And we have some people that are the charismatic extroverts and all that kind of stuff. And then we have very reserved people. Some might even call socially awkward people. And some of those socially awkward people we see, they don't have a thing to go to. So for professions, they choose music education because music has been an important part of their life. It gave them a social group, but they already find it difficult to build connections with even people that are like them, much less people that are not like them. So opinions or thoughts on how to deal with it? Because I do think you're right. I think the way we make these changes is building connections, but building connections can be difficult when someone's not like us or if we are just internally more introverted or socially awkward. Thoughts on that?
So I you're exactly right. It's really easy to build relationships with people that are like us. It's not so much people that are different. So I think we have to be very intentional about how we go about that. We all have the common bond of music because we wouldn't be in the same room if we didn't. So I think that's a place to start. You ask about, well, what kind of music do you listen to outside? What does that mean to you? And you start with that one common thing, because we have something, that one common thing, and then you can start finding that and be willing to listen. You may not agree with how they feel or their viewpoints, but you're willing to listen. And if kids feel heard, just like adults, if we feel heard, then we already have that connection. Even if we don't see things the same way, we have that connection because you listened to me. You took the time to hear me. You took the time to find out something about me. And I think that's the first start. And you be very intentional with that. With our socially difficult kids, I think it's the same thing. You and I both know people who have been socially awkward that went on to have great careers because they learned how to relate with people. And I think that's a skill that to a certain degree can be taught. I'm thinking specifically of a young man I had several years ago who was very, very socially awkward and just struggled. And We just kind of took him in and accepted him for who he was and knew that he didn't read social cues well, didn't do any of that well. And he wanted to do a solo every year at contests. And I would just cringe because he was so left-brained that he could not, you know, get the emotional side of music. And I really struggled with teaching him how to do that. But you know what, Donovan? It was interesting. His senior year, I was finally smart enough to take him in. He was the first kid after lunch. So we were able to go in the room and he could go in and just kind of check it out. I said, this is where you're going to stand. This is where you're going to put your music stand. I'm going to sit off to the side because I'd learned he was a clarinet player. And that was my major instrument. So I would sit off to the side because anytime he would make a mistake, he would look up and meet my eyes. So I was smart enough to say, okay, I need to sit off to the side because he didn't even want me in the room for the first couple of years. And so I'd stay outside, but I would sit off to the side and I said, here's what the judge, I even described what the judge looked like. The kid, he got one at district and then was so overjoyed. And when he went on to state, it was the same deal. And I bawled over that too at state than a lot of the ones we've ever received because that kid was able to stand up and he played musically, he played beautifully. And something inside him broke after that. I don't know what it was. He went ahead and went on his senior trip and he drove a boat on their senior trip. This is kid didn't even drive a car yet. Went on to get his license, went on to Mizzou. He went to Mizzou, Donovan. I couldn't believe it. He was even one of the homecoming candidates. He's gone on to have a very successful career as a counselor. This is a kid who couldn't even deal with emotions in high school.
Right, right.
So, you know, I like to think that music was the thing that helped him get past whatever it was that held him back from being able to relate to people, because he's really successful now. So I think it's difficult for people. And like you said, we do have people that are socially awkward, but they can be overcome. Again, these are skills that can be taught, and they are skills that can be learned. There's a young man I'm thinking of specifically who's been through the mentoring program. And when he first started coming, I was like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do with him? Because he really could not. He's gone on to be a pretty successful teacher. And so it's interesting. I think so much of that we judge, and we have no business judging. I know I'm the world's worst at that. I think, oh, this kid's never going to be successful. Well, you just never know. You just never know what grit is in a person, because I really think it comes down to building relationships and grit. Truly, those are the two keys to being successful in the classroom, is knowing how to build relationships, and you just have the grit to stand up and do it again the next day. And that's not easy. You know, teaching grit is something that I've been struggling with. How do you teach young people that? How do you teach young teachers that? And to me, so many of them have shown so much grit just showing up this year after finishing a student teaching year where they weren't even in person, a lot of them, and they're walking into a classroom and trying to teach. If they just make it through the year, to me, that's a huge success, whether their kids have learned anything or not. Mm. If they sign that contract for next year, then that is a huge win. I really believe that. And I think that all of us need to give ourselves some grace. We need to, if you're showing up and your kids feel safe in your room, they feel cared about, I don't care if they've learned their scales or not, you have been successful, because those are the two things right now that they're lacking in. They're lacking in being feeling cared for. Not saying that parents aren't doing a good job, but we're all under a lot of stress. It's just, you know, this repeated stress of the pandemic. And, you know, everybody's like, oh, it's not that big a deal. Well, you know, it's not. I'm liking it to being a 5-pound weight. Carrying around 5 pounds is nothing until you carry it around every day, all day, and don't ever get to put it down. And we've been doing that now for nearly 2 years. And I really think that people just need to give themselves a little bit of grace. And again, just don't worry so much about whether your kids are learning. They're learning. They're learning to be resourceful. They're learning that they can still laugh when things are under pressure. They're learning to have a good time, and they're learning how to deal with stress, just like we are. And I think as long as they see us doing that, we're being successful.
I think another piece to that, because I think you're right, but although sometimes, and maybe this is just me being a little jaded, and again, I hope you don't mind if I slightly push back just a little bit, but I ultimately agree with what you're saying. Sometimes people can hear that message and just think like, well, the fact that you survived is success, and feel like, that doesn't sound like how I want to spend my career, you know? But I think the reason why saying like the fact that you survived, the fact that you made it is success, is that if you're a thoughtful person, which most educators are, and I'm meaning thoughtful, not in the sense necessarily of like thoughtful towards others or like a kindness or anything. I'm just thinking like internally thoughtful. If you're the kind of person that can go home and maybe after a glass of wine or two can reflect on your day and think about like, okay, I got this issue with this kid. Let me evaluate what happened today. What was the problem of my day? I wonder what I could do different. You know, listen to that podcast. Chris Sprague was talking about asking student like what kind of music they listen to or what do they do for fun. Maybe if I could build a connection with a student, maybe he'd be less of a problem in my class. Okay, tomorrow I'm going to try that. And so going in and each day trying that approach, and then at the end of each day reflecting and evaluating and trying to improve. Survival, making it another year, that tenacity, therefore means the job gets easier each time, because you're not just like going through the motions and just standing there like a punching bag, getting beat, and then showing up the next day and trying to do that for 30 years. No, you've got to go home and think about how to make this better and then try to improve slightly. And the problem, of course, as we start our careers, is we really know almost nothing about what it takes to do it. And so it just feels super overwhelming and daunting to be successful when we think we just don't have what it takes to stick to it and to make it be a success, to have a 30-year career like what you had. But the reality is if you will be intentional about it, it gets easier. And I'm going to do a brilliantly smooth segue right here and talk about it can get exponentially easier if you've got partnership and mentorship. And I'm a huge believer in mentorship. It's been probably the single largest thing that's helped me to have the career that I've had at Springfield Music. Without my mentors, there's no way I would have been in a position where I own Springfield Music like I'm able to do now. That would have never happened without mentorship. And the value of a mentor guiding you along the way and giving you input from their experience and knowledge is immense. And it's the difference between success and failure. And I think even the difference between feeling fulfilled and feeling like there's a lack of fulfillment in your job. So talk to us about mentorship, because I feel like we've done a nice job up to this point of painting a nice dark picture of what education can be. And I'm sure there's people that are like, you know, saying, asking Alexa to find out how they can resign their jobs, have, you know, now I'm like, what else, other careers, what is the starting pay at Walmart right now? And
right.
There is hope. We didn't just do all this to have a max exodus from teachers. Like, we actually believe there's hope and a way to make things better. And mentorship is a big, big part of that. So talk to us about the MMEA mentorship program and your thoughts on mentorship in general.
Well, before I do that, I want to go back to what you said. You're exactly right. Being intentional is so important, and in reflecting on what you can do better. I love how you said that you go home and you reflect, okay, so what can I do to make this one situation better? You can't be overwhelmed by all of it because it's just too much at the beginning. And as I said earlier in the podcast, we talked about young teachers are so overwhelmed with everything that they don't know. They think they can't do it for 30 years. You don't. You just have to do it one more day and make that day better. And finding ways, and you're like, well, I don't know how to do that. Well, that's where your mentors come in. And that's part of the reason why I think the MMEA mentoring program is so important to me, because after my first 3 years, I quit. I was so overwhelmed. I didn't think I had what it took to be a teacher. I didn't think I could do it. And so I took 2 years off. I worked in a factory and a night shift, which was great, working midnight to seven, and then wondering all the time why I wasn't teaching. And then at the end of those 2 years, there was a lady that came that I worked with. Said, I don't know if you're interested, but there's this little school down the road that's looking for a music teacher. And so I thought, well, if I'm ever going to get my feet wet, this is the place, because there were no expectations walking in. Mm-hmm. And I've been there ever since. And thank goodness I made that decision to go back in the classroom. But I like to think, had the mentoring program been in place back then, I might not have gotten out of the classroom, because I would have realized that the feelings that I felt at the end of those three years during those 3 years were perfectly normal, and that every teacher had them, and every teacher has that sense of failure at the beginning, because we don't know how to fix everything that we're confronted with. So I think that's why it's so important to me that we have this formal mentoring program in place, and that it, one of the most gratifying things to me, and you saw it, got to see it this fall, is we bring those young teachers in, and you can just, at our mentoring conference, and they look like lost sheep, and they just feel like, you can tell they've made a huge mistake with their life. And then by that evening, when they start to realize that everyone else is feeling the same way, and they start to talk and start to visit and start to realize, oh, I'm not the worst teacher in the world, it's going to be okay. They start to realize that, all right, we've got this. And I have now people that I can count on, that I can ask questions. We started last year because of the pandemic. We started the monthly mentoring meetings, and we just meet by Zoom every Tuesday, second Tuesday of the month. And there was one young lady, and I don't want to call her out, so if she's listening to this, she'll know who it is, but she was at every single one of those monthly meetings. And we all, as the old people, we were worried to death about her, because she looked like she was about 12 years old and looked like she was ready to quit by, you know, October. The end, we got to the end, and it was funny. It was so much fun to watch her transformation, because she came to every mentoring thing she could get her hand on. She was asking questions. She was emailing me. And in August, she said, well, I signed my contract for next year. And the demeanor to watch her go from that little timid kid to starting to see herself as a teacher was huge. And it was such a blessing to us. But that's a young lady who had just decided, you know, I'm going to get everything I can out of this. Mm-hmm. And she came to MBA this summer, and she was asking questions. And finding, you have to, as a young teacher, I know it's hard, because all of us old teachers will say, well, if you need anything, just call. Because we don't want to seem like we're telling you what to do, but most young teachers are not going to reach out. So it's part of the reason we put that, I guess, mentorship program in place, even though it's kind of forced at the beginning, but then they can start meeting people that they know. And I think it's really important, for we tell young teachers, find someone who's near you that you admire that you program your admire or that you think you'd like to get to know better, and just meet them for coffee, buy them supper or whatever, and just pick their brain. Because that is the only way that you really get better at your craft, is having someone that you can bounce ideas off of. Sometimes it's just having someone to tell you, yeah, you're doing the right stuff. You just got to keep doing it. And sometimes it's someone saying, hey, have you thought about trying this? This works for me. What have you done? And sometimes it's just having someone to help you think through the process. Because when you're in it, it's just like anything else. When you're in it, you can't see the big picture. So it helps to talk to someone else to be able to say, hey, you know, this is, maybe you should try this. One thing that also to let young teachers know is that the mentors learn just as much from you. I'll never forget a young man contacted me a few years ago and said, I'd just like to have coffee with you once a month. Can we do that? I was like, sure. And so he was in year like three or something, two or three, and we would just talk. And he would ask me, well, why do you do this? Or why do you do this? Or how do you do this? And it was really good for me, because you get to this point in your career and you just kind of do things on autopilot because that's how you've always done them. And you kind of forget, okay, why do I do this? And so you're like, okay, yeah, I need to change it because I've gotten this habit of doing this. Or, well, this is why I do it this way. So it's really good for both. It's not just for the mentee. It's really good for the mentor. But I also try to tell young teachers, don't just get an old person. You need to meet someone who's only a couple years in, because so many times they can't see themselves in my position. They can't see themselves in 20 or 30 years, but they could see someone who's two or three or 5 years in. They can see themselves in that position. So if they can find someone that they can talk to, that's really important too. So you kind of have both levels, I think, are very important to that mentor relationship.
Gosh, certainly the MMEA mentorship program is just something that all educators should be involved in, whether you're in it as the mentor or the person who is being mentored. But that's such a great program. But I would encourage everyone to just that one-on-one mentorship for someone that's in your district or neighboring district. In my experience, every educator that I've ever talked to ask if they would be interested in mentorship or sharing or giving, I don't think any of them have ever said no. Everyone that's had any degree of success, most of them are more successful than what they realize. Many of our successful educators, they themselves don't necessarily see them as successful as successful as the rest of us see them. And when someone tells them like, hey, actually someone would love to hear how you've done this, they think, oh, I haven't really done anything. Like, yes, you have. And like, they'd really like to know how you've done it. And they're just willing. They're more than willing to share. And if one could be so bold as to just take the initiative to reach out to someone that you respect something about their program or themselves, I promise you that they will be flattered that you would be interested and would be happy to share. And if you're not bold enough to do that, because there's a couple of people I'm thinking of right now that the idea of just out of the blue reaching out to someone to set something like that up just sounds horribly intimidating. I'll give you permission right now. Reach out to me or reach out to any of our school service reps, or maybe if you use another company, you could probably use their school service reps, but likely your school service rep probably knows someone who would be a great mentor for you. Or if you have someone that you'd like to talk to, they probably know that person and would be happy to make an introduction for you, because your school service rep wants to see you be successful too. And that can be a great resource to make that connection. And if you're a school service rep listening to this, be active in trying to get these mentorships and relationships together. And I know I was talking with one of our longstanding reps, Mike Guffey, who's been a road rep to the stars and has served many, 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 many directors over the decades he's been with us. He was trying to set up a mentorship program and he had both parties willing to meet, but couldn't get either one of them to actually like make that initial reach out connection of like, hey, let's do this thing. And so I said, all right, when you see that person this week, I want you to stand next to them and grab their phone and say, right now, text them and like do this right while I'm in front of you. Like do it. And because what was happening was the younger teacher, just every time they'd get to it, they'd start getting into their head and they just think, I'm afraid I'm going to sound stupid. I'm going to sound awkward. They're going to think I'm dumb. I'll do it later. I need time to think about it. And so, they're standing there and just making them like, hi, this is such and such. Can we meet? Like, that's all it took. That broke the ice and that relationship started. But he had to sit there and almost force them to do it right then. And sometimes that's what it takes. And if that's what it takes, if you're, like I said, a road rep or whatever, do it because it's important and it will help these people, you know, have success and be successful in their careers. And you know, we want to see that. It's obviously it's good for our business if educators are good at their business. Like that's the obvious side of it. But most of us that are in this, we're in it because we're either former educators or people that wanted to go in education. But before the business, there's a love for music and a love for musicians. And that's why we do what we do. We're certainly not doing it for the money. I mean, not that I don't know that we would do it as much if we weren't getting paid, but we're not doing it to, we're not going to space or anything like that. Like it's, there's not that kind of wealth in it, but we do it because we love it and we want to see people be successful. So anyway, well, I think that mentorship program is so great. And I think combining the one through MMEA with also just trying to find people in your district or neighboring districts that you can meet with, I just think that's going to help you deal with a lot of these complications and challenges that we presented. And it's going to give you another ally to go drag that administrator down onto your podium and stand there and listen to you teach that general music class and make them have to, you know, come up with better discipline and other ideas of how to confront that.
Well, you're right, Donovan, and it's so cool that we have now, one good thing came out of pandemics, what we're doing right now, talking over Zoom, you know, because now you can pair up because before it was so hard sometimes to find the time to meet for coffee or whatever. Now you just jump on at home and sit in your pajamas and talk with someone across the state who is in a similar situation you're in. But you're right. Sometimes it just takes that third person to make people connect. And that's one thing I love about our business and music education. There's not one person who, I don't want to tell anybody my secrets because I want to keep it all for myself.
Nope.
I mean, you see these people after their BOA performances and they're cheering for each other. And hey, did you try this? And that's what makes music education so special, is that we want everyone to succeed. We want to give you our secrets. We want your kids to be successful too. And that's why I just love it and have felt so blessed to have spent all my time, you know, my career in this education. It's been an incredible blessing to me.
Well, and you've been a blessing to others for sure. And I think one of the weird things about music education is that we have, you know, this competitive element that's a part of it, which actually has really nothing to do with music or arts. And I'm a competitive person somewhat, but I still don't see it. And when I go, like when I watch a DCI competition, I don't care who wins. Like, I'm just amazed by the quality of all the groups, even the ones who came in last. I'm thinking, God, that's amazing. And then obviously you see the top groups and it's amazing and don't care who wins. I'm not in it to see who wins it. I'm in it to be entertained and to be inspired and to be amazed. And same thing when we listen to music and our music groups play. Like, yes, I know we have contests and stuff like that. Maybe it's kind of a nice tool just to sort of get a sense of a scoreboard of how you're doing possibly, but it's not really about the contest results, about making music. It's about having that experience. It's about connecting to something deeper inside of you. It's about connecting to your fellow musicians. It's about connecting to our audience that's listening. And it's about entertaining and expression. Like, that's what it's about. And if someone decides to assign a score to it, great. But most of the educators I know are not wrapped up in the score, and they're not wrapped up in the placement, and they're not wrapped up in the trophies. They're wrapped up in their students' lives, or wrapped up in music and teaching music, and they'd be happy to share that with any others. And Chris, you've certainly done that over your career, and especially as you've been involved in MMEA leadership, and super grateful for you that you've done that. And you're a great ambassador, not only for mentorship and music education, but also for teaching in small schools. And really grateful for all that you've done, and glad that you came back and left that factory job to come back to this. What a waste that would have been. I'm great for the factory, I'm sure. Like, they would have, you know, you would have been great there too, but education needed you. So I'm grateful for you. This was one of the more animated conversations I've had over this topic. I'm either going to get a lot of people that go like, you know what, I loved it, or they're going to be like, nah, that was too much.
Yeah, they're going to be, well, try to make sure you tell them to listen to the end whenever we talk about the good stuff.
Thanks for listening to the Mo Better Bands podcast. If you have something to share, click the links in the show notes of your podcast app and leave us a message.
Or email me directly at donovan@springfieldmusic.com. That's D-O-N-O-V-A-N at springfieldmusic.com. If you'd like to be a guest, would like to recommend a guest or a topic, shoot me a line. Thanks again for listening.